your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, everyone for liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, start today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud our boys in line.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 100 years ago on June 28, a 19-year-old Serb named Gavrilo Princip shot and killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria and his wife, setting in motion the catastrophe that was World War I. Our guest for the first part of the show says, to many Americans, World War I was a muddled, confusing clash of powers that you move through as quickly as possible in a long-ago history class on the way to studying World War II, which offers a comparatively simple good versus evil narrative, greater American involvement, and riveting films. But when you want to understand why the world is as it is, the backdrop of some of the most important economic and diplomatic challenges of our era, the Great War is the first place in history to look. We're going to be talking this first part of the show about why World War I matters to today's economy. Neil Irwin is joining us, senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, writes The Upshot, a Times site for analysis of politics and economics. He's the author of The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers, and I don't know if I have the full title. There's something in a something fire. We'll have to look up the exact title here, which is about the efforts of the world's central banks to combat the global financial crisis. Later in the hour, Gary Shulman will be joining us. Gary is president of the Greater Milwaukee United Nations Association. He has taught about the Great War period in many universities in the country. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Actually, it's three central bankers and a world on fire. I just couldn't read my handwriting. We'll be welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. That's how you reach our conversation this hour. Hello, Neil. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it is interesting when you think about what's going on in Iraq right now and World War I is being woven into so many conversations, how little it is that we know about this war, how we do overlook it and go right to World War II. Why do we do that? It's an important war to understand.
I think that's right. And I think the reason is it's very confusing and it doesn't have a kind of simple, crisp narrative. I know as growing up in history classes, I always really didn't have an understanding of why it even happened. And I think part of that's the reflection of what a disaster it was for humanity. Why did it happen? Well, there still isn't a really satisfactory answer. It happened because you had these great powers in Europe, some on the rise, some in decline, and they were kind of chafing up against each other, and it led to a really unnecessary conflict that really transformed the rest of world history and shaped so many of the conflicts we deal with today.
Yeah, and so let's talk about the title of your piece, Why World War I Matters to Today's Economy. Why?
Well, I wrote this piece in part because a few years ago I was working on this book, The Alchemists, about a modern financial crisis, about what happened from 2007 to 2012. And it was shocking. Here's something that's an ultimately modern story. And I realized over and over how many of the trends and forces I was really writing about date back to World War I. That's most true with the European debt crisis, which was really about this idea of European unity, which was itself a reaction and an attempt to grapple with the kind of war that characterized Europe through the first half of the 20th century. You can't understand why the conflicts and tensions between Germany and France and Greece and Italy are the way they are now if you don't understand how this awful history happened a century ago this week. And that applies in a lot of other areas, too. So if you look at the conflict between Russia and Ukraine right now, civil wars in Syria and Iraq, a lot of the long thread of history really runs through the Great War.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about for Germany. I have read, I think, at the Times in another piece that their defeat in this war laid the groundwork for revolution, fascism, and genocide. They could have, this author writes, dominated Europe in 20 years economically if they had not gone to war. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. The, you know, Germany in 1913 was a rising power. It had unified only a few decades earlier. It was becoming the industrial powerhouse of Europe. It was becoming a truly prosperous economy and becoming wealthier and more populous than the great powers of the previous era, which were Britain and France. You can imagine a different timeline of history, an alternate narrative where there was a peaceful rise of that power, and there was a constant kind of give and take of who was more powerful or more wealthy in Europe, but ultimately it could have been a peaceful adjustment. It was not, of course. Instead, you had 15 million people die in the Great War. It was at its root about this rise of Germany and its how its borders were going to exist. Now, how did that lay the groundwork for everything that followed? Well, the reparations, the Western powers that essentially won the war, did not handle it well. And in the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, they had a punitive approach and tried to punish Germany for its expansionary things. And that led to the hyperinflation of the 1920s, the rise of Adolf Hitler, the rise of Germany as really a driver of World War II and all the horrors that involved.
Mm-hmm. You say in your piece that the clash of Russia and Ukraine, the Eurozone debt crisis, and the civil wars in Syria and Iraq all have important lessons in how to deal with an expansionist autocrat. And you talk about the emergence of China as a global economic powerhouse trying to assert itself. It reminds you in some way of Germany's rise in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
It does. You know, you have an emerging power that has the combination of a bit of expansionism and eagerness to assert itself on the world stage, combined with a certain insecurity and wanting to be respected and taken seriously as a global powerhouse. You know, China is now the world's second biggest economy, and you see some of this in some of these clashes that China's having with its neighbors, with Japan, with South Korea. So far, it's been relatively peaceful. It's over minor island territories that have disputed control. But, you know, what we have to hope is that the Chinese leadership and their neighbors in Japan and these other countries really have learned the lessons of history, and that China's ascent onto the global stage and its ascent to becoming a global power can happen in a way that's more peaceful and more understanding that we all have too much to lose to let tensions over territories, over wealth, to let those lead into a catastrophic war.
We sure don't learn that, do we? I mean, we just can't learn that. We never learn it.
Well, it's true. We all try and learn from history, but then never seem to. I think there are some signs that it's not. That's not entirely the case, though. You know, you see, for example, in the debate over how the West should handle Vladimir Putin and Russia's incursions toward Ukraine and other former Soviet states. And you see a real difference between the Europeans and the Americans on this. And I think that really has to do with the Americans are thinking of things through the mindset of World War II, which is if you let an Adolf Hitler, take over more territory and more land, it can only end in bad things. That's a combination of bad forces. Some of the European leaders are learning the lessons of World War I, which is you don't want to get in a tit-for-tat battle that leads to a stalemate and mass death. So it's a funny thing. The two countries in the U.S. versus Europe, which war we learn our lessons from.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, is our guest this part of the show, and he wrote a recent piece, Why World War I Matters to Today's Economy. Our number is 800-486-8655. Michael in Minneapolis starts us off. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. I like your show very much, and actually, you are the star of the whole show.
Thank you.
Okay, and the point I am trying to make is that usually wars, it occurs because there is conflict of interest, and there was the French and the British colonizing the whole world, and the Germans, they only had a couple of colonies, and there were lots of tension because of that. And I would like to say that Queen Elizabeth I, she said one time, war has a strange ending, and he always was afraid of listening to her advisors to go to war, because at the end it won't be sometimes as you wanted. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Neil?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, one of the great lessons of World War One is that it's not just, you know, wars frequently are not just a zero-sum game, they're a negative-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you compare Europe in 1920 versus in 1913, it was a much poorer place. It was, you know, approximately 15 million deaths. It was a far, you know, I think people don't understand how the degree to which, if you go back to 1913, the world was looking like a wonderful place. There was a global interconnections. There was had been peace for decades. There had been a rise in standards of living in much of Europe. You know, things were looking up in 1913, and it looks like the world was headed toward greater prosperity and a greater peace and greater financial and trade interconnections. And that fell apart starting in 1914. I mean, I think it's hard to overstate what a disaster for humanity the period of 1914 to, say, 1945 really was. It's just, you know, between the Great War, between World War One, the Great Depression, World War II, it was a time when all the progress that mankind had made toward peace and prosperity seemed to be undermined by these series of revolutions. And that's a very sad story.
Yeah, it is. Thank you, Michael. John in Canada. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. How are you, John?
I'm fine, thanks. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm a Canadian, and I'm blessed to live in this great country, the United States. But the reason why Americans don't generally know very much about the First World War is that you weren't in the First World War until the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, in the Second World War, it took the attack by Japan to get the United States into the Second World War.
That is true. How late did we enter? We're going to talk more about this the second part of the show, but I'm sure you have an understanding of this. Why were we reluctant to enter? When did we enter, and why did we enter, Neil?
Well, I think the key is there's this long tradition of a sense of isolationism in the United
mm-hmm.
States, and a sense that we have these giant oceans protecting us from other advanced nations, and that's enough to guard us, and we should focus inward and focus on ourselves. And that was a particularly strong impulse a century ago when World War One was getting underway. It took things really getting out of control for us to enter. It is true that American involvement in those late 1918 period, that was really decisive in finally shifting the balance of power in the war. That said, this really is the moment. I mean, we talk about the long arms of history and how this period 100 years ago affected our world today. This was really the moment at which the United States became a global powerhouse. It was World War One that undermined the British Empire, that led to the slow decline of British influence over the globe. At the same time, the U.S. was not scarred by this war. Even though we participated at the very end, we didn't bear nearly the cost of Britain and France and Germany and all of Western Europe. So we were really left in this place in 1919, 1920 when the war was over to assert ourselves on the global stage, and that's what began to happen. If you look at the history of even financial dominance. So New York became the global financial capital in a way that London had been through the 19th century and early 20th. So it's a real turning point for America and the kind of American experiment as a leader of the world, which is, of course, solidified in World War II, which is, as the caller mentioned, we entered only after we were attacked at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. How do you explain the event 100 years ago on June 28th, where we have the assassination of the Archduke of Austria and his wife, and that just mushrooming into this huge war that involves so many countries? I don't understand that.
Yeah, it really is hard for a modern student of history to understand, and I have trouble with it myself. It's funny, I was reading the New York Times' coverage of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand on, I believe, June 28th, 1914. And and it's amazing. It's you know, there was a story that kind of understates what the impact would be, saying events may upend European politics, which was literally the understatement of the century, that this may upend European politics. You know, it's an interesting chain reaction of how each nation one by one ended up, but it's like dominoes falling. And, you know, so Germany declares war on Belgium, and Britain had a pact to defend Belgium, so suddenly Britain's in the war. It's a series of kind of ping-pongs of why each country got involved. You know, again, this gets back to this idea that Americans, including myself, are not as intimately familiar with this history as perhaps we should be, given how mm-hmm. important it is for understanding the world.
Yeah, it is amazing to me how much it's come into the headlines and our discussion of what's going on today in the Middle East, isn't it? That we just, let's remember World War One history now all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Iraq right now, you know, you have Kurdistan in the north, you have the Sunnis and Shias in the rest of the country fighting it out. You know, and part of the, you know, Iraq as a political entity exists out of the after effects of World War One. Same with Syria. You know, it's very much the case that this muddled, difficult world we have in a number of regions in the Middle East, even in Africa, is a result of what happened a century ago on the battlefields in Western Europe.
Neil Irwin is our guest, the first part of the show, senior economics correspondent for the New York Times. He writes for The Upshot, a Times site for an analysis of politics and economics, and a piece that he wrote over the weekend on the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War II caught our attention, and we're talking to him about it this hour of the program. And a little bit later, Gary Shulman will be joining us. Gary has taught World War One history at many universities in the country and did his master's and PhD dissertation on the topic. So he will join us as well. Here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Up to mighty London came an Irishman one day. As the streets are paved with gold, sure everyone was gay. Singing songs of Piccadilly, Strand and Leicester Square, till Paddy got excited, then he shouted to them there. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go.
It's always interesting to listen to the music that defines a war or defines an era. These songs are going way back, but they were songs that were very popular during World War One. A really powerful anti-war song, too, which is quite simple and very direct, which we'll play at the end of our program today. Neil Irwin is with us this hour, senior economics correspondent for the New York Times. World War One started 100 years ago, June 28, and we're talking about it this hour of our show. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Mary Jo is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hello, Mary Jo.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Okay, the reason I'm calling is to point out that today people are joining the war. We have a volunteer army. People are joining because they cannot find a job and they cannot afford to go to college. This will bring some money into their household, and maybe they'll get a free education on the GI Bill. Same thing goes on the other side. Over in the Middle East, people are desperately poor. They join the war because they can get a few dollars a day for being in a war. Now, in the past, World War One and World War Two, we had a draft army. You were drafted. You were brought up to believe that this was your duty as an adult. Someday you were going to have to go, and if you didn't go, you might go to jail. It wasn't until the Vietnam War where people stood up and said, hell no, we won't go. Now we have a volunteer army, and people are going, but not because they want to kill a Kurd or a Shiite or a Sunni. They're going to put bread on the table for their family. So So I just wanted to bring that up, how the economy is also intertwined with the war.
Thank you for your call, Neil.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, one, you know, it so on the one hand, in the World War II and Korea and Vietnam War in the United States, it is true that military service became something that cut across class boundaries, and especially in World War II and Korea, was something that was shared whether you were rich or poor, whether you were from the city or the country. And that's not the case anymore. Now it's you know, the U.S. military is, even though it's a volunteer army, it's largely people from poorer parts of the country. It's you know, more bifurcated along income lines. A lot of wealthier or more urban Americans don't have friends who are serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's a different cultural experience. And I think that has consequences for how we think of conflict and what we think of as the cost of that conflict. It's not just money, it's human lives. It's people get wounded and have troubles for the rest of their lives. You know, there's a interesting parallel here with World War I, which is part of the reason the situation I know best is Britain. Part of the reason Britain was so committed to this fight, and they continued for so long at such a massive cost, is because the people dying in the trenches were by and large working class, and the elites by and large did not have their sons. Even if their sons were part of the conflict, they weren't the ones dying in mustard gas attacks in the trenches in France. And I think, you know, the importance of having the people in power understand that there are real human consequences, and not have there be one group of people making the decisions and being able to be not terribly concerned with how many millions of working class citizens die is a terrible situation. And I think part of having modern democracies is making sure that leaders are cognizant of what the consequences are of their decisions for everyone in society, not just the elite.
Mm-hmm. It was such a brutal war, wasn't it, Neil? I was reading about the numbers of people, the number of civilians who died in this war, to say nothing of the 8.5 million soldiers from both sides who died. 20 million severely wounded? Ooh, what a horrible war.
It is, and I think what had happened, you know, when this thing started 100 years ago this summer, everybody thought it would be quick, and, you know, the line in Britain was, it'll be over by Christmas, our boys will be home by Christmas, and it lasted 5 years. Mm. And I think part of the miscalculation was that it had been decades since a significant European conflict, and there had been a lot of technological advancement during that time, machine guns, tanks, explosive devices. And so this chemical weapons as well, mustard gas.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think this exacted a worse human toll than the decision makers understood when they were entering things in 1914, when they had grown up in the era of the cavalry and you're riding horses and using rifles. Well, now there's machine guns and mustard gas and airplanes and all these horrible technologies for killing people. And so part of the reason the toll was so great is that the decision makers did not understand what was at risk by entering the conflict.
Yeah. We've always heard, at least when it comes to World War II, that it was a real help to the American economy. It just really, you know, got things blooming here because even though times were rough, we were building tanks and ships and pouring a lot of money, and a lot of industries were up and running. What was the economic fallout from different countries? And I know there were so many involved, it was probably different from country to country. But were there countries that experienced a more booming economy as a result of the war?
You know, it's hard to look at it as anything. You know, there are some countries that had a decent run during the 1920s, though all of that went away in the 1930s with the Great Depression. But, you know, you look at some of the economic consequences. I look at Germany first and foremost. So they had these massive reparations payments because of what they had to agree to at the Treaty of Versailles to end the war. And to fund these reparations payments, the government just printed money. And they printed money at such a great pace that they had hyperinflation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the stories from the early 1920s in Germany, it's amazing. You know, you would go into a restaurant and the price of your meal would have risen over the course of the hour it took you to eat your dinner.
Woo.
Inflation was so high. You have pictures of children playing with stacks of cash as like their building blocks because it was so worthless. people would go to, you know, bring a wheelbarrow of cash to the grocery store to buy their food. If you had savings, they were completely wiped out. So the entire generation of middle class and upper middle class, kind of the German bourgeoisie, saw its savings wiped out by the hyperinflation. The very week that the German hyperinflation peaked was 1923, November 1923. That was the very week that a young World War I veteran named Adolf Hitler launched the Munich Beer Hall Putsch, with an initial foray in his ultimate rise to power. Mm. It's hard to overstate how much the consequences for the German economy of the war were horrendous, and those disastrous economic consequences are what directly led to the rise of the Nazis, mm-hmm. fascism. Mm.
Let's go to Scott in La Crosse next. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm really enjoying this program, and before I ask my question, this you are absolutely right. As I understand it, the drawing of the boundaries by the winning parties carving up the Ottoman Empire at the end of this World War I conflict is gave us precisely the mess we've got right now going on in the Middle East. So thanks a lot to our forefathers. But my question involves a comment I heard your guest make just a little bit ago, that the British office or ruling class didn't suffer a lot in this war, and I was under the impression that just the opposite was true, that all these officers leading these troops would go out to the trenches, and they would get up and lead the charge. And unlike today, when we try to have all of our soldiers, whether they're officers or enlisted, look fairly similar in terms of not having a lot of identification on them that marks them as officers, that here these officers in the British Army were up there just advertising themselves as sniper targets and getting knocked off just in droves. So can you just maybe clarify that for me?
Yeah, I'm not a historian. I hope our next guest can offer a more definitive answer. We might be talking about slightly different things. The political leadership back in London making the decision of, how do we fight this war? How long do we stay in it? How much in resources do we devote to it? Versus the officers on the ground, I believe I have heard what you describe, and don't doubt it, that the officer class of the British Army was more at risk than they are in modern wars, partly because of the conventions of how you fought at that time. The simple fact, though, is if you look at it, Britain spent 5 years and an untold amount of wealth and millions of lives for reasons that are, with historical perspective, aren't even that clear. What did Britain have to gain from doing this? And the fact that there seems to have been a kind of collective, well, we got this far and we invested this much in it, we can't back away, seem to have been deeply entrenched in the political leadership in London. But I would be curious to hear what our next guest, our historian, has to say about all of that.
Yeah, thank you, Scott, very much. One more phone call for you, and then we'll go to the historian on the program. Where are we going? Port Washington and James. Hi, James.
Hi. Love the show. Love the topic that you guys are on.
Great.
I wanted to just to mention that the guest originally had spoken that Europe had approached it and today approaches things from more of a policy of appeasement and trying to get along, whereas the United States tends to look at things in terms of threats. And something I like to point out, yes, the Treaty of Versailles was incredibly punitive on Germany. It did set things in motion to cause what happened later with Hitler's rise to power. But keep in mind that the British, with their prime minister, Neville Chamberlain, he adopted a policy of appeasement with Hitler. And he gave Hitler just that breather that he needed to rearm and become a menace to the rest of the civilized world. Thank you. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you very much, James.
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate. I'm not trying to suggest that we should only learn one of these lessons. I think the two world wars and how they came about show the kind of the two ways things can go horribly awry. And the run-up to World War II very much is a story of appeasement of Hitler and a failure of the other countries in Europe to stand firm and prevent his aggression in taking over the state and land and Czechoslovakia and ultimately Poland. At the same time, there's a risk on the other side, and if you overreact to every threat and every instigation, you can end up in a bad spot as well. And I think it's wise to understand both historical experiences and realize that it's there's risks on both sides, and there's risk in underreacting and overreacting to territorial aggression by autocrats.
So because it's easier sometimes for us to remember our history or start studying it in conjunction with a major anniversary like the 100th anniversary, are you going to write more about World War One and the economy during the next 4.5 years, Neil?
I suspect so. It's it's the regularity with which things come up in the news, in today's news,
right,
that really have echoes back 100 years. Again, it struck me how regular that is. And I think the overarching theme is that, again, as I mentioned earlier, the world was looking pretty good in 1913. Great economic advances, great interconnections, peace. And this is the biggest lesson of World War One is how fragile that kind of era of global peace and prosperity is. And we have a good thing going right now, and the global financial crisis of a few years ago has not led to the kind of conflict and mutual distrust and global warfare that we saw 100 years ago. And I think it's incumbent upon all of our leaders to remember how important it is to try and maintain that liberal world order and that sense of peace and prosperity that's better for all of us.
Thank you, Neil. Nice way to end with you. Neil Irwin, our guest, the big chunk of the program, his piece, Why World War One Matters to Today's Economy, in the New York Times and on our Facebook page, I believe, as well. He's senior economics correspondent for The Times, writes for The Upshot, and is the author of The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World Fire, which is about the efforts of the world's central banks to combat the global financial crisis. We are going to continue. We'll speak with a historian of World War One as we carry on our conversation about World War One, the first of, we hope, several conversations during this year about a war that we probably all could learn a lot more about. That's why we're doing this show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There were summoned from the hillside. They were called in from the glen. And the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Let no tears add to their hardships as the soldiers pass along. And although your heart is breaking, make it sing this cheery song. Hearts are yearning, though your lads are far away, they dream of home.
This hour of the program, we're talking about World War One. Gary Shulman is with us. The next portion of the program, Gary has taught courses on the Great War at UW River Falls, UNC Charlotte, and UW Milwaukee. His master's and PhD dissertation focus on aspects of the war in Germany. He also is the president of the Greater Milwaukee United Nations Association. Your phone calls will still be just fine during our conversation, so stay where you are or call us if you'd like. 800-486-8655 is the number. Hello, Gary. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Very kind of you to allow me to exchange my passions with your audience.
Yeah. Well, I know you've studied it for a long time and quite thoroughly. And one of the things you wrote to me, you said that your thesis is the Great War really is still going on today. You look at Iraq, you look at Syria, Cuba, and North Korea. Could you amplify on that? How is it going on today?
Sure. Well, the obvious thing is what you've been talking about so far, the Middle East crisis, which, of course, comes from the treaties that we'll talk about later on. But also, a number of events taking place during the Great War, the Russian Revolution. Where would we be without the Russian Revolution giving us communist states still existing in North Korea, Cuba, Vietnam, and, of course, China, where the Communist Party rules the whole big country, including its free enterprise zones. So we've got, post-colonial ethnic conflict in Africa, the breakdown of the colonial empires really started during the war, although the League of Nations sanctioned it. It was really not until after the Second World War. But the notion in Africa that people deserved a different life than the lines that the missionaries, traders, and whatnot had drawn to form countries in Africa that were actually colonies of the great powers. So all of this conflict, you know, is rooted in the shaking loose of forces that in the Great War.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes refer to the Great War as the Gordian knot of history. You may know the legend of Alexander the Great coming, and nobody could untie the Gordian knot, so he took a sword and you know, these forces that led to it to the start came into it, and then all of the everything coming out.
Mm-hmm.
One component coming out that was resolved by the Second World War was the rise of fascism in Imperial Japan. You know, that the dissatisfaction for the outcome led to these states becoming aggressive and, you know, the success of the Nazi and fascist parties.
Talk more about what happened with the carving up of the Middle East, because we're hearing so much that attention wasn't paid to various religions, to various sects, that in some way contributes to the mess that we're in today.
Well, it originated in secret negotiations in 1916 and 1917. Should point out that 1916 was the deadliest year of the war. It was the year of the Battle of Verdun, the Battle of the Somme, the Battle of Jutland, the only naval confrontation between the German High Seas Fleet and the British Grand Fleet. The loss of life was really pretty dreadful. And down in the Mesopotamian front, probably just give a quick rundown of who's in the war by 1916. It may surprise some of you to know that the first power to join the British and the French and the Russians against the Germans was Japan.
Hmm.
Why Japan? Well, they were interested in a lot of the German territory in the Pacific, and especially in the province of China where they make Zhentao beer now, which was a German brewery originally. So that you've got this lineup of powers. Turkey came in at the end of September 1914. The Ottoman Empire at the time was in serious decline, but it had worked with both Germany and Britain on improving its military, but they controlled the whole Middle East. Ottoman Turkey controlled the Persian Gulf, except for Persia, which is today Iran, and all of the Levant, which is, of course, in discussion today.
Mm-hmm.
This area was under conflict, and it wasn't doing that. The British weren't doing that well with their colonial troops going up the Euphrates River to Baghdad. So looking to the future, Sir Mark Sykes, a British diplomat, and Monsieur Picot formulated the famous Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916, which lay out the first map of the Middle East. And
mm-hmm.
what it was to project that Turkey would lose the war and that all this Turkish territory would be available and that France would take over what are today Syria and Lebanon and that Britain would take over Iraq and Jordan and Palestine. That was the plan.
I see.
The war ends, Turkey loses, and all of this territory is available. If you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, you
mm-hmm.
know that Saudi Arabia and some other areas did not, fall into this trap. But when the League of Nations was formed following the Paris Peace Treaties, then the map that Sykes and Picot had kind of laid out, with Winston Churchill kind of leading the way, laid out the boundaries today.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the map that's there, and that is why the League of Nations is probably most culpable because they gave France the mandate to administer Lebanon and Syria. They gave Britain the mandate to administer Iraq, Jordan, and Palestine.
Hmm. Why was this such a bloody war, Gary?
Well, a couple of major reasons. One was the new weapons. As we know, the cliche, Woodrow Wilson took the United States into war to make the world safe for democracy. But I would say the first instrument of democracy was the machine gun, because it knew no class structure and was, just mowed down people mercifully. The second factor was the tactics used were similar to those of the American Civil War, which involved mass charges against entrenched positions. And the machine guns and the exploding artillery that was discussed in the earlier half hour, that was the killing machines were much more efficient. The weapons came along that were much, made it much more difficult. And the original German plan to encircle Paris and hold firm on the Eastern Front against Russia bogged down very quickly in September of 1914 at the First Battle of the Marne outside of Paris. And that actually, in my view, is where the Germans lost the war, because they lost the ability to strike fast and so forth. So what evolved was what Winston Churchill later called in a book a jagged line of trenches and barbed wire from the English Channel to the Swiss border. And that became a war of entrenchment and defense rather than motion until 1918, when the Germans tried for one more breakthrough. Mm.
Let's talk about the British for a moment. We had a leftover question from the last half hour, and that's British officers and whether or not they really took hard hits during this war. And also, what was in the interest of the English to become involved at all?
Well, the start with the involvement. The British did have a agreement with the French at the turn of the 20th century called the Entente Cordiale, which later became the Triple Entente, in which it was a defensive treaty that allied them with France and Russia and put Germany in jeopardy of a serious two-front war, which, of course, happened. Now, the British officer class, just am slogging through one of the first 1914 books to come out this year, Max Hastings, I'm sure you're aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is Margaret Macmillan, which I don't have. But Hastings makes a point that the British aristocracy, which made up most of its officer corps, were much better fed and weller off, in contrast to the working class Brits and Irish, who were, had pretty lower diets. So generally were much smaller. The enlisted men were much smaller than the officers, which I had never really thought of before.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often in the early cavalry charges, of course, who was riding the horses but the officers? And they were easy targets for the German Mauser rifles and so on. So the officer corps took a heavy toll. And, I think everybody who's followed Downton Abbey knows the impact that the war had on the ruling class.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls for you. Rick is calling in from Monona. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I'm enjoying your program, although it's such a tragic subject.
Mm-hmm.
The one question I had, or that I wanted your guest to comment on, and that is, at one point in the war, the things were so bad, and the enlisted men were so angry about being sent out to slaughter that they actually refused to fight for a time. Would you like to talk about that just for a minute? I thought that was a really interesting chapter on World War One.
Yes, there was a famous mutiny in 1917. The French soldiers refused to fight, and finally our Marshal Pétain came in and took over and, causing the rally. There was a film with Kirk Douglas starring as one of the officers in that one. I think it's Price of Something of Glory, The Price of Glory, or something like that. But the French army took one heck of a beating for 3 years, and come 1917, after the Somme and after Verdun, if anybody travels through eastern France, I urge them to visit Verdun, because the battlefield is still very much evidence there, along with the mausoleum and a museum and the fields of crosses and crescents and Stars of David, showing the cost of it. But mutiny was put down, and essentially from that point onward, the French just sat on it until the U.S. forces came in to back them up, and which, of course, did not happen in combat until June of 1918, except for one detachment of African-American soldiers, which General Pershing didn't hesitate to send right to the front with the French.
Mm. Thank you, Rick, so much for the call. It's easier for us to understand World War II, I think, because you get this sense that you're fighting against a great evil and there's something to be fighting for. World War I seems much more difficult because it's still hard to get a sense of why everybody was fighting, Gary. There were huge numbers of people. It's hard to understand why the U.S. became involved.
Yes. The U.S., of course, Woodrow Wilson ran for re-election on the slogan, he kept us out of war, and mm-hmm. kept us out of war for a number of reasons. One was, I think, United States had come in after the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915, which was a British ship that was carrying arms, that we would have been allied with Tsarist Russia, with the Russian Empire. Mm. You know, it's hard to make the world safer to democracy when you've got a very strong effort there. And it took a long time. Now, just to do a quick rundown, the opposing powers were, of course, Germany, which was backing up Austria-Hungary, which where the Archduke, by the way, the assassination of the Archduke was a convenient cause, but not none of the causes. I would say the bigger causes were the competition for empire among the great powers, the sort of falling apart of the social fabric of the world, and the alliance system, and militarism. Militarism was very, very common. If you were to go to any major event in any country in 1914, the men would be in uniform in one way or another. And every country but Britain had a draft, a conscription of soldiers.
Hmm.
So there was an inevitability that the war was going to happen, and it didn't take much for it to happen other than the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which consisted of what is today a part of Poland, Czechoslovakia, all of Hungary, Croatia, Slovenia. All of these territories were part of a polyglot empire that was falling apart. And on the other side, in the Balkans, you had a Turkish empire that was falling apart. In the middle, you have Serbia, which is aspiring to become a kingdom and powerful, that it had its king assassinated before 1910. It just was an incredibly volatile system. So the Austrians took the excuse of the Serbians not meeting the demands they had made on them after the assassination. By the way, Archduke Ferdinand was not the favorite of Emperor Franz Joseph, who is now in his 90s, but he was the only one there. He was the heir to the throne. The date of the assassination was also the national holiday of Serbia.
Oh.
And Serbia is probably the only country I know of that has a national holiday for the defeat of its army to the Ottoman Turks in 1344, the Battle of Kosovo.
Huh.
And Kosovo is a familiar name for everybody in recent times as well.
Do you have, as we all want more information about World War I, because we are in this year and it's a good time to study it, do you have a recommendation of a book to read before you have to say goodbye?
Going back to the original topic, I would recommend reading a book out called Lawrence in Arabia by Scott Anderson, who's a journalist. Journalists tend to write clearer history than historians
mm-hmm.
do. This book, you may have even had him on or know of him, but it really outlines why things went wrong with the remapping of the Middle East.
All right. Thank you, Gary. Thanks so much. Gary Shulman with us the last part of the program. He's a World War I historian, has taught in many places, and including UW-Milwaukee, taught World War I several times. thank him for being with us and our earlier guest as well. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing the program and to K.P. Whaley for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. We've been weaving songs in and out because it really sets a time. And this is a simple but a pretty direct and powerful part of an anti-war song from World War I. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Great conversations are ahead.
I brought him up to be my pride and joy. Who dared to place a musket on his shoulder to shoot some other mother's darling boy? Let nations arbitrate their future troubles. It's time to lay the sword and gun away. There'd be no war today if mothers or